morning. This is the House House File 3800 Transportation Policy Conference Committee, and we're waiting on more copies of the side by side for the public, and we're sorry about that, but there'll be more copies coming up soon. I thought this morning what might make the most sense is go around the table and find out everybody who's here, and then we'll go through the side-by-side and we'll talk about what's in each of the bills, same and similar, what's in the House only and the Senate only, and we won't be moving any language this morning. We'll be talking about the decisions we need to make, and we'll break at about noon for an hour or an hour and a half, and then when we come back, we'll be ready to move language and start adopting amendments. So if we could just start here and go around and people say who's here. I'm Representative Melissa Hortman, and this is my first time chairing a conference committee, so please understand if I make mistakes.
Matt Burris with House Research.
Corinne Zewers, House Fiscal Staff.
Abby Mahan, House Transportation Committee Administrator.
Representative Terry Morrow.
Representative Michael Nelson.
Minnesota House.
Representative Shelley Madore.
Katie Sieben from the Senate.
Senator Mike Jungbauer.
State Senator Scott Dibble, Chair of the Transit Subcommittee in the Senate.
Kelly, our Subcommittee is assigned to the Senate Transportation Committee.
Krista Boyd, Senate Fiscal Staff.
Bonnie Berezovsky, Senate Counsel.
Steve Murphy.
And with that, we're going to have Matt Burris walk through the side-by-side.
Madam Chair and members, the side-by-side is There's both language that contains all of the language of the respective bills, and then there's a summary as well that should be in your packets. And it's entitled Side by Side, aptly named, hopefully. And I'll be working through that summary as opposed to the language. Just a couple of quick comments on the format of the summary. It provides some reference material back into the language if you want to see the actual bill text with the article section and line numbers on both the House and Senate side. There are some comments that include a little bit of summary analysis of differences in the case where there's a similar provision between the House and Senate, but some policy or technical differences. And there are, in some cases, some staff recommendations. I would like to note that the staff recommendations are if the committee chooses to adopt these provisions. It's not a recommendation that anything in particular be adopted. It's just a guide with respect to the technical differences that we have discussed among staff on the House and Senate side and had some thoughts on. The other thing I might note is on the summary on the Senate side, a number of times it says see House language. That's just with respect to the summary itself. Instead of repeating all of the same text in both the House and Senate columns, just so that you know there could be differences in the actual language, and that's noted in the comparison portion of it. Moving into the side-by-side then. One other thing on this, on the organization, it's categorized into four sections. Roman numeral 1 starts on page 1, and these are the provisions where the language between the House and Senate is the same, or there are just technical differences, not substantive differences. Roman numeral 2 starts a little ways in on page 9, and that's where the policy differences start, those where it's a similar provision, but there are some substantive differences between the House and Senate. And then on page 15, Roman numeral, skipping one. On page 14. It's a typo. That should be Roman numeral 3. That's where the provisions that are only on the House side start. And then finally, the other Roman numeral 4 starts on page 18. And from then on are the provisions that are only on the Senate side. So I'll be going through it based on these four categories of same, similar, or policy differences, and then House only and Senate only. And I'll be referring to my counterpart at points to help me when I stumble. Jumping in then on page 1, page R16. One more comment on this, sorry. The R page is also a reference to the page number of the reviser side-by-side, the actual language. So that all the Rs are into the language if you want to see that, as opposed to looking at the more brief summary of the side-by-side summary. On page one, R16, first provision is a expansion of being able to have disability plates. It allows a second set of plates subject to approval. Also on that page is a conforming change for that provision. On R17, there's an expansion of a temporary 60-day permit. Right now that applies only to a certain subset of types of plates. This would expand it to apply to all types of plates. On R21, there is a expansion of exceptions for when a U.S. DOT carrier number is required. And then on R23, there is a directive to the Department of Public Safety that spotter truck titles don't need to be issued. There are actually several provisions related to spotter trucks throughout this. Just to summarize, the basic concept is to not require registration of spotter trucks, which are vehicles used primarily within a shipper's or freight operator's yard. They are not typically operated on public roads. The provisions in this, in both the House and Senate, allow for the spotter trucks to not be registered, not be titled, and be operated only under limited circumstances on public roads. Jumping back, page R23, neighborhood electric vehicles. Again, there are multiple provisions throughout, and the in both the House and the Senate, the basic concept is to introduce a new category of medium-speed electric vehicles, which are similar to neighborhood electric vehicles, except that their maximum speed capability is raised from 25 to 35 miles per hour. There are a couple other differences in the actual vehicle. So this is one piece of it referring to the titling being required. R24 is the first of several provisions that deal with towed vehicle contents. The basic concept there is allowing people whose vehicles have been towed to be able to get their contents under some circumstances without having to pay to actually get the vehicle from the impound lot operator. And this first piece refers to the transfer of the title if agreed to by the owner of the vehicle. On R25, this is another piece of the towed vehicle contents, and that continues through R27, essentially establishing how the waiver and change of rights work and what contents can be retrieved and who can retrieve them, what the qualifications are. On R29, again, is another piece of the spotter truck. Also on R29 are implements of husbandry. Again, there are multiple provisions with this, and this is an agency provision to centralize and modify how implements of husbandry are regulated. There's some changes with regard to trailer requirements and brakes. The key things have to do with implements of husbandry needing to follow bridge postings and weight limits on bridges. Part of that is a delayed effect of the 8, and part of that goes in right away. There are a couple of definition changes that reference federal regulations. That's hazardous materials on R30. There are a couple others later. And then on page 3 of the side-by-side summary, R30, again, medium-speed electric vehicles. It's another piece of that with the definition. R31 relates, again, to implements of husbandry and the operation on the right side of the roadway, extending a little bit into the left as necessary. R33, again, neighborhood electric vehicles. R37 it's another agency provision modifying how what kind of requirements there are for having brakes on trailers and semi-trailers. R41 has another definition, a provision, again, relating to spotter trucks so that they have to be inspected and treated as commercial vehicles. R41 as well contains another piece of the annual inspection by the State Patrol for spotter trucks. On R43, there is a change to license plate display. There are multiple changes on the regulation to clarify how the plate is displayed. R44 contains another piece of the implement of husbandry changes, as does R46. And there, I'm actually skipping over some of the staff recommendations on technical differences. We could jump back to that later if there are questions on the details behind that. But in general, or actually in all cases, the intent behind noting the technical differences is that it's not a substantive difference. If the committee is interested, we can get into it further, but otherwise it's purely technical. On R47, there is a clarification on the harvest season increase that a permit is issued for operating trucks under the weight increase. R47 also contains a requirement or a change in requirement for stopping trucks to be weighed, lowering the weight of the truck when under the case under which they have to stop. Hazardous materials, again, this is the definition change for federal regulations. R50 contains technical changes to school bus definition. R54 establishes new requirements for Type 3 school bus drivers. This has a couple of provisions throughout. This is arguably the main one that actually lays out what the set of requirements having to do with background checks and notification to employers for Type 3 school bus drivers who can operate a sort of a school bus that's treated for definition purposes as a school bus, but it's actually more of a would be a station wagon or a passenger car. It wouldn't look like a traditional school bus, and it can be operated without a license endorsement. This establishes several regulations for that type of operation. R56 has a broadened exemption for licensure requirements relating to the military. R61 has a clarification to the revocation of commercial driver's licenses in connection to DWI violations. R62 also has, or I guess that's a separate page. R62 has a notification for notification requirements for commercial driver's license holders, notifying their employer in the event of convictions for certain offenses, certain DWIs. R63 is also related to that. Oh, sorry, R63 is the employer notification piece of that. R65, again, is related to Type 3 school bus operators. R67 is a reporting requirement for MnDOT to provide an annual report on transit services in Greater Minnesota. R69 creates a definition of out-of-service order, and that's creates a reference to federal regulations on out-of-service. R69 also makes some changes to, it was one of the first of several changes to household goods movers. There are several household goods related provisions in here, or a few in both the House and Senate. And the essential changes are to eliminate the public notice and hearing requirements for new entrants who want to become household goods movers, as well as eliminate the capability of current household goods movers to block new entrants and provide for the permits issued by MnDOT to be statewide. R70 is an expansion of fine capability relating to railroad crossings. R70 also establishes penalty information for both out-of-service orders and the railroad crossing-related fines. R71 is a piece of the household goods movers permit, as is R72 and R70, both on R72. R75 has a change to enforcement powers for the state patrol relating to out-of-service requirements, as does R76, The difference between R-75 has, it relates to actual state patrol troopers. R-76 deals with the with other employees who aren't sworn peace officers. R-81 is a clarification that opt-outs in the metro area can provide service outside the transit taxing district and has some technical changes. R-86 establishes that the city of Minneapolis can restrict so-called Jake brakes, truck engine brakes, along a portion of Interstate 394. R-88 has a couple of trunk highway turnbacks. R-89 contains transfer of right-of-way to the state rail bank, the description of certain, I believe that's old rail going to the rail bank. R-93 is another technical change related to the Type 3 school bus provisions. R-96 is a piece of the changes to the transportation finance bill that was enacted earlier this year, clarifications in that. R-98 is another piece of the transportation finance bill that's Chapter 152, as R-98 and R-99 relates to that as well with the violent capture study. Section 2 starts on page 9 of the side-by-side. These are the cases where there is a policy difference of some sort between the House and the Senate. R-11 has a modification of the definition of medium-speed electric vehicles. That actual definition change is the same between the House and the Senate. The Senate has some additional provisions that change the definition of trucks and vans. R-12 has there is a new exemption established for certain vehicles owned by state hospitals and social service agencies. Actually, I believe the exemptions are already in law, and this could make the language conform with other registration tax exemptions for other vehicles. The Senate has that same provision as the House on that piece of it, but the Senate also includes a registration tax exemption for other vehicles relating to nonprofits who own vehicles and only use the vehicles for disaster relief issues. R-24, this is a technical difference that relates to the towed vehicle contents. The staff recommendation here would be to use the House version of that. R-33 is another piece of the spotter trucks. This provision here is the regulation of where spotter trucks can go and how they can be operated on public roads. In the House version, there's an additional allowance for spotter trucks to be able to be driven directly to and from gas stations and service stations for gas and service. With regards to the technical differences between the two, the staff recommendation would be the Senate provision. R-36 is, again, related to the Type 3 school bus. This is a personal cell phone call prohibition extending it to Type 3 school buses. Under current law, there's already a provision for other school bus operators from using a cell phone for personal calls. The House has a little bit of additional language on that we could get into. R-47 is a tow truck permit. This is a piece of the towed vehicle contents, and in the House, this permit is for each vehicle. In the Senate, the permit is a single cost for all of the vehicles that a tower has. R-49 has another school bus provision. This is, again, with the Type 3 school buses. And in the House, again, there's an additional term that doesn't exist in the Senate. On R-50, the provision is changing the driver's license endorsement requirements. So that's required on any commercial driver's license. This is another piece. Actually, this is separate from the Type 3, but it also relates to school buses. This is an agency provision. The Senate language includes some conforming changes for some Senate-only language that we'll get to later. R-59, this is one of the graduated driver's license provisions. This places two basic sets of restrictions. One relates to the number of passengers that a provisional license holder can have. The other relates to the times of day, restricting driving between midnight and 5 a.m. There's a list of several differences between the House and Senate on this. And on the effective date, there's a technical difference where the staff recommendation I need to double check on. R-65 refers to the change in appointment of by the commissioner of deputy commissioners and creating a deputy commissioner chief engineer, or specifying that a deputy commissioner is a chief engineer. There's a difference in how that how those requirements are laid out between the House and Senate. R-66 is a directive to MnDOT to prioritize its metro area funding based on federal funds. The House language, in essence, is a stricter requirement that this prioritization must be done by the commissioner. The Senate provides a little bit more flexibility to the commissioner and has some other differences, including how the effective date works. R-67 is an implementation plan for transit meeting more transit service needs. And in the House, this is the requirement is both developing and implementing this plan, whereas in the Senate, it's just development of a plan for how to go forward. R-80 contains an assessment that the Met Council would need to annually do as part of its evaluation process, and the assessment would be of progress towards meeting transit goals for people with disabilities. This actually might be miscategorized. We'll need to double-check on that, but I think it might be technical differences there and not a policy difference. R-48 contains modifications to the ban on planning or studying or referencing the Dan Patch commuter line. There's a difference there in when that would go into effect. R-85 contains a report on the urban partnership agreement. Other than the reporting element, the urban partnership agreement provisions are traveling separately in the House. And they're included as primarily, they're mostly included as Senate-only files. The difference in the report is that on the House, there's a requirement of evaluation of some of the findings and results from UPA to possibly apply them to other corridors in the metro area. R-87 contains a requirement that MnDOT accept a bid for road construction in Duluth. There are a number of differences between the House and the Senate on this. The House version is more general at a very high level, whereas the Senate version lays out a number of additional requirements and specificity. R-50 refers to a requirement of planning and design for any new bridge on US 52, the Lafayette Bridge. The Senate identifies improvements as well as reconstruction, whereas the House only references reconstruction on this requirement. And then R-93 contains a repealer. A couple of the repealers are the same between the House and the Senate, and then there are a couple that are different. The ones that are the same are another piece of the implements of husbandry and a piece of the household goods movers provisions. And then the House only has a technical piece that is a provision, again, relating to the towed vehicle content. On the Senate side, I'll defer to Ms. Berezovsky.
Madam Chair and members, the Senate repealers that do not exist on the House side are the first one has to do with other provisions on design build that are on Senate that are Senate only provisions, and this is a repealer that connects with those sections. The second repealer on the Senate side repeals a temporary surcharge of $5 for special veteran plates that is no longer apparently needed to be collected. The third one, I think, is on both sides. The fourth one has to do with driver instruction on school bus and with changes that are made on Senate on the Senate side only, that particular subdivision is no longer needed. The fifth one is the same as the House repealer. And then the sixth one has to do with, in Senate-only language, there is a change to the transit taxing district, which abolishes the current configuration of the transit taxing district and makes it contiguous with a full metropolitan area. And this repealer is connected with that language.
Madam Chair and members, R99, moving on, is the another piece of the changes to the Chapter 152, the Transportation Finance Bill. R101 refers to another piece of that as well, as do R103 and R105, and these overall deal with some clarifications of the finance, as well as a couple of other small policy changes and provisions. Moving on to page 14. These are provisions that are only on the House side. On R2, there is a clarification of how titling would work or will work with watercraft, so that the property rights for the watercraft would only trigger needing to get a certificate of title if the watercraft itself has to be titled. On R2, there is a requirement that that school districts that contract out pupil transportation have to have, as part of the contract or an addendum or related documents, certain information related to the pupil transportation provider. R4 contains a requirement on, again, relating to school bus transportation, that school bus driver employers have to pay for the full-time work, and allows for the drivers to refuse to operate a vehicle if they identify specific problems, specific safety problems in a pre-trip inspection. R15 has some technical changes related to vehicle registration. This is a cleanup / clarification item. R30 is the first piece of a so-called text messaging ban. It's actually written as with reference to wireless communication devices, and a ban that's more general than just text messages, extending to emailing and surfing the web and so forth. And this is the first piece of that that defines what the devices are. R31 is a conforming change. I'll get to the main piece of that, which is actually R32. It's a requirement of moving. It's a move over law, kind of similar to how it works for the state patrol, something that was passed a couple years ago, and would apply to freeway patrol and road maintenance and construction vehicles. And this is a essentially, drivers would need to move over to the left of those types of vehicles when they're parked on or stopped on the side of the road, and there's a citation allowed for that. R36 is another piece of the text messaging ban. R42 establishes a new penalty when a commercial motor vehicle inspection decal is forged. R58 establishes additional requirements for provisional licensure, and these have to do with establishing in statute what the minimum hours of instruction are before you get the license, the provisional license, and some increasing the amount of hours of actual drive time that the person, the learner's permit holder, has before they can obtain the provisional license, as well as establishing a penalty if there was a falsification of that logbook of hours. R60 establishes new content for driver's education relating to safe interaction and awareness of trucks. R60 is a modification to the so-called Dimler Amendment, which would raise the speed at which you could get a ticket and not have that ticket go on a driver's license, go on your driver's license, so that if you're going 10 miles an hour over the limit in a 60, it wouldn't go on your license, whereas right now you could be going, it's just 5 miles per hour over the limit. R61 is also related to the driver's ed interaction with trucks. This piece requires putting additional information in the driver's manual. R82 contains a requirement of the Met Council to provide in a more centralized fashion its financial and ridership information on all of its light rail transit lines. R86 is a requirement of a study that the Department of Safety would evaluate methods and come up with a proposal, and as well as a request for proposals to send out.
On this provision, I think Representative Hausman had some information about a credit card study that may already have been completed.
Would you like me to hand this out now?
Yeah, I think before we move past it.
Members, this just came to me this morning, and so the copies I have actually have my notes on them. There was a credit card task force that presented a report, and this was the legislature in 2006 asked for this. The report was submitted to the 2007 legislature. There were recommendations and options to facilitate the use of electronic payments. You know that the demand on the part of the customer to use their credit card just increases. The governor just signed the use of debit cards for custodial accounts, for those who manage a custodial account. So that is growing. And this was brought to me by the South St. Paul office of the DMV. They have done an enormous amount of work. Getting an opinion on the current law, and the finding, I believe, says that law is clear and no further work is needed on this issue. They have worked with Nationwide Payment Solutions. That, as I understand it, that company has invested significant dollar amount to set up this. You see a communication from them. And this office has worked with MasterCard, and both MasterCard and American Express have changed their rules. And Visa, my understanding, is about 2 or 3 weeks away. They will come on in June. And so there is a significant amount of very recent activity around this. They, on a daily basis, have angry faces at their counter as people come in intending to use their credit card. You know that the DNR and others have this capability. I think there are particular issues that the department might need to assist with to make certain this happens. My understanding is you just want to get the subject out there and not have discussion, but so that you have the letter from the attorney and information from the credit card companies about that. There were 7 recommendations in that report. This particular office kind of methodically worked through all the recommendations, has done all of them, including installing an ATM machine, which apparently had to be generic because they couldn't promote a bank. It's a rather expensive thing for a customer coming in. The fee that the customer pays is significantly higher than a customer feels comfortable doing. So that is the issue, and it just for your information for later discussion to get on the table.
Thank you. Are we asking questions at this time, Madam Chair?
On that credit card study?
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, is there a charge here for these companies? Is that included in the fee, or are we going to opt the fees to cover the charges?
That is what this office has negotiated with MasterCard and American Express, and I believe somebody is here. My understanding is that the negotiation has gotten that fee down to, I'm not certain anyone's in here. I think it was, I just heard this this morning, I think it was $1.75, which would be lower.
That's right.
Oh, it is there. It is.
It is 2.45%.
As you can see, this I just got this literally before I came over, so I have not read much of it myself.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, does that mean we up the fees to cover the fees, or what?
Well, as you know, they don't have that option. The DNR, there's one recommendation from that 2007 report. That the DMV was not able to do. Parks and Recreation, they control their cost, but DMV, their fees are set in statute. So that's why they had to negotiate with the credit card companies to control that in a different way. But there's no proposal here to raise fees. Was that your question?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, yes, it would seem to me that there's going to be a loss of revenue if you have to pay a fee to the charge company, and or they may save money because they don't have to go out and collect checks. So there must be a balance there of some sort.
Madam Chair, the woman is here. If you want to ask her a question now or whether you'd prefer.
Representative Hausman and Representative Earhart, I think that Pat McCormick is out of town, and she will be here on Monday. And so this is maybe an issue that we should discuss when Pat McCormick is here and she can give her perspective. Senator Youngbauer, did you have a question or a comment?
Well, more of a comment. I kind of was speed reading through this, and it seems like if we merely did it like doing any other transaction, when you go to a lot of the units, whatever they're called, to get your cash from the cash machine, they tell you about a transaction fee. You simply post to that, because a lot of people would have no problem paying an extra transaction fee to be able to use their debit card or their credit card at motor vehicles. So I think we've pretty much come to this shows us a solution that I think is fairly reasonable for all people, and I don't know that we need to do a whole nother study as we're getting closer to these things, but it's no different than your transaction fees you pay at a lot of the cash machines anyway. So
okay, with that, I think we'll go back to the side-by-side.
Madam Chair and members, R88 contains a provision that would name any future commuter rail or rail line along Trunk Highway 12 from Wilmer to be the Little Crow Transitway. R88 also contains a provision that names an act that was previously removed from the House side, so the staff recommendation would be to not adopt that. R90 establishes a study requirement for MnDOT to look at salt and de-icing practices and their impact on water quality. R93 is the start of Article 2 on the House side, and this article contains a set of provisions related to railroad walkways, establishing requirements for new tracks, older tracks, how compliance would need to work, what waivers and enforcement procedures are in place, exemptions for older track, essentially a set of regulations related to walkway. I'll jump down then to R103 at the bottom of page 17. This is another provision related to the Chapter 152 changes to fix a typo. And that takes us to the Senate-only provisions, and I'll defer again to Ms. Berezovsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And beginning on page 18 of the summary side-by-side, the Senate-only provisions, there is a series of provisions that relates to the design-build method of constructing transportation projects. And the first such provision is on R2, and that is in Chapter 13 of law. It classifies MnDOT's audio recordings, which are required in a later provision, of meetings with design-build proposers as protected non-public data. And these recordings would become public when a project is awarded. The next two sections on R4 have to do with the UPA proposals. And the first is a definition of dynamic shoulder lane. The second is the authority for the commissioner to charge user fees on the dynamic shoulder lanes and the HOV lanes. And it allocates the fee revenues. It exempts the program from toll facilities laws and municipal consent, and it establishes a petty misdemeanor, which consists of operating a vehicle in an HOV lane or dynamic shoulder lane that is not consistent with the commissioner's requirements. The next several sections have to do with design build. The first one on R6 requires the commissioner to pay reasonable compensation to technical review committee members who are not public employees. And it also requires at least two state employees on the technical review committee to be administrative engineer level or higher. The next provision on R6 has to do with the required contents of the RFQ for a design-build project. And it just says that any reference to establishing criteria to be used in the RFQ evaluation process may not include a proposer's previous exercise of legal rights. That's presumably in challenging the department's processes. Section 6, which is on R7, requires the TRC, the Technical Review Committee, rather than the selection team, to evaluate design-build qualifications of responders to the RFQ. The next provision is Section 7 that removes a requirement that design-build RFP include the relative order of each criterion. It still requires that the weight of each criterion has to be specified along with the weight of sub-criteria. RFP also must include a statement that past performance or other evaluation criteria cannot include previous exercise of legal rights. Section 8 on R8 is also design build, and that makes several changes to the project award, computation, and announcement laws. It requires the TRC to reject any non-responsive proposal. Current law states that the committee may reject a proposal that it deems non-responsive. It also requires the design builder who is selected for a project valued in excess of $10 million to have the lowest adjusted score that does not exceed 120% of the lowest price submitted by a responsible design builder. That same section requires the commissioner to state the value of the time factor in the RFP if time is a selection criterion. It prohibits the commissioner from limiting the proposer's award protest rights, and it requires the commissioner to delay execution of the contract until 7 days after the project is awarded, the scoring data are disclosed, and the successful proposal is publicly identified. On the next page, R9, Section 9, is also design build, provides that any increases to the stipulated fee must be made only by the commissioner, who must publicly announce the reasons for the change. Section 10 requires the TRC to reject any non-responsive proposal in the low bid design build process. Now we move off of design build, and in section 11 there is a requirement Not a requirement, excuse me, it's permissive, that the Commissioner of Transportation may consider Insurance Institute's findings concerning safety when designing safety improvements on state aid and trunk highway projects. Section 12 on R11 exempts two-wheeled motorized vehicles from Metropolitan County wheelage tax. Motorcycles are currently exempted, and this broadens that exemption to other two-wheeled vehicles. Section 13 is not here, although, well, Mr. Burris commented on it. It's partly identical to the House and partly Senate-only language. It's already been explained. Section 14 is the definition of changes the definition of special mobile equipment in the vehicle registration chapter of statute. It clarifies the definition. It removes the examples of various categories of special mobile equipment, and it removes concrete pumps and street sweeping vehicles from special mobile equipment, and those are dealt with a couple of separately in a couple of sections down. We'll get to that in a moment. Then, let's see, Section 16 provides that spotter trucks may not be taxed as motor vehicles and are exempt from vehicle registration. Those the sections dealing with spotter trucks are immediately effective and expire in 2013. Section 17 on R15 provides that concrete pumps and street sweeping vehicles will be taxed at 15% of the Minnesota base rate schedule and requires them to display distinctive plates. Then we come to some special license plate provisions. On Section 21 on page R17 authorizes the issuance of Bronze Star Veteran and Silver Star Veteran special plates. On the next page, Section 22 on R19 authorizes the Minnesota Sesquicentennial license plates. Next section, American Red Cross special plates. Section 25 imposes a penalty on special mobile equipment that is used to transport people on the public streets. The next section conforms a definition. The next two sections, 35 and 36, require the deposit of license fees and fuel decal fees that are paid to the commissioner, and this is license fees under the International Fuel Tax Agreement, that requires them to be deposited in the vehicle services operating account, which I believe conforms to the current practice of the department. Section 37 amends the definition of school bus to include multifunctional school activity bus and amends definitions of type A and type C buses and multifunctional school activity buses as well. The next section, Section 39, is part of the UPA definitions as well as Section 42. Section 45 on R32 requires the driver's education curriculum to include instruction on the duties of a driver when encountering bicycles and pedestrians. R34, Section 48, is part of the UPA legislation that provides that operation of buses on dynamic shoulder lanes is not subject to the law that permits use of shoulders by buses. Section 49 on R34 states certain required elements if a municipality adopts an ordinance that establishes a permit program for long-term disability parking. It must follow certain specified limitations. Section 50 on page R35 creates the Office of Pupil Transportation Safety as a section under the State Patrol, and that is funded later on the Senate only provisions. Section 52 on R36 requires the Commissioner of Public Safety to adopt rules that require a minimum of 30 minutes of instruction on pupil transportation laws, and it includes public school driver training programs. On Section 54 and 55, these are the booster seat provisions. They require approved child passenger restraints for children under the age of 8. The current requirement for child restraints is under the age of 4. And it eliminates exceptions to the required use of child restraints for taxis, airport limousines, and buses. On R39, sections 56, 57, and 58 are the primary seatbelt law. And those change the current seatbelt law by applying the requirement of wearing a seatbelt to all passengers in a passenger vehicle, commercial motor vehicle, commuter van, Type 3 school bus, Type 3 Head Start bus, and certain pickup trucks or vans with gross vehicle weight rating under 10,000 pounds. It leaves the fine at $25, as it is in current law, for each violation. But it does apply that to any passenger under 15. And the driver is responsible for the fines that are assessed because of people under 15 who are not buckled up. It provides that the court cannot impose more than one surcharge on the driver, even if there are several $25 fines imposed. And it allows primary enforcement of the seatbelt law. This section takes effect on June 9, 2008. And the next two sections are technical and were requested by the Office of Traffic Safety in order to conform with NHTSA requirements. Sections 67 and 68 have to do with truck weights. Section 67 establishes a special canola hauling vehicle permit, and this is geographically limited in scope, and it allows a permit for a vehicle or a combination with a maximum gross vehicle weight of 105,500 pounds, which I believe conforms with the North Dakota law, to operate on certain specified routes and subject to seasonal load restrictions and other restrictions. And then Section 68 allows 2- and 3-axle vehicles to exceed seasonal weight limitations when transporting heating oil or liquefied propane gas for heating use only. Section 69 on R49 requires the uniform traffic ticket to display a notice of the existence and the amount of the state surcharge that will be imposed on that violation. Section 52 allows a Class D driver's license holder to operate a multifunctional school activity bus under conditions that are now specified for operation of a Type A school bus. Section 76 is part of the seatbelt law, and there's actually another part of it, too, that I think was in one of the earlier parts of this summary that just strikes inconsistent language from the instruction permit section and the provisional license section having to do with seatbelts, since under the primary seatbelt initiative, there would be one standard law that applies to all license holders who are driving. Section 78 on R61 requires the commissioner to include pupil transportation laws in the driver's license examination, and the next section requires their inclusion in the driver's manual. Section 83 on R63 authorizes the commissioner of public safety to suspend a driver's license without hearing when the licensee is a registered owner of an automobile and who attempts to pay registration taxes, fees, or motor vehicle sales tax with a dishonored check. And the suspension continues until the check is made good. Section 84 makes it a misdemeanor for a person to drive after license suspension that was imposed solely because of unpaid fines or failure to appear in court. Section 85 adds a revocation for any person, including a juvenile, for a controlled substance offense to the types of revocation that trigger the testing requirement and a $30 fee for reinstatement. Section 86 clarifies that the requirement that schools and contractors must verify the validity of driver's licenses of employee drivers also applies to drivers of multifunctional activity buses. Section 91 creates an advisory committee on non-motorized transportation to work with MnDOT and to issue an annual report to the commissioner. The committee expires in 2014. On the next page of the summary, Section 99, and this is related to sections that exist in common in both bills, having to do with placing commercial vehicle drivers out of service, and this expands the enforcement authority to transportation and hazardous material program specialists. Section 100 and 101 74 are part of the same initiative, and these have the effect of exempting resorts, marinas, and houseboat rental companies from the ethanol requirement if they sell gasoline with an octane rating of 87 or higher, and if that gasoline is delivered into on-site bulk storage. The current rating for these, the current octane rating requirement is 91, so this takes them out of the 91 rating requirement and gives them an 87 requirement. Section 102, that relates to the international fuel tax agreement fees and fuel decal fees going into the vehicle services operating account. I spoke about those earlier. Next two sections, 105 and 106, require the seller of a motor vehicle to disclose to the buyer if the vehicle has sustained damage which exceeds 60% of its actual cash value. Current law requires notification if the damage exceeds 70%. Section 107 is related to the seatbelt law, as is Section 108, and this provides that the surcharge, the state surcharge that applies to violations, will be assessed at $25 for seatbelt violations. Section 109 declares that district heating and cooling nonprofit corporations are eligible for grants and federal money for utility relocation for light rail projects, unless their eligibility would impact the cost effectiveness index.
Definition is.
Sections 112 and 113 are related, and these extend the transit taxing district to the entire metropolitan area. Section 114 is related to the Advisory Committee on motorized transportation, and non-motorized transportation, excuse me, and that just conforms an old law to this new organization, this new group. Section 117 requires MnDOT and the Met Council to create certain reports that are required in this bill within current appropriation levels. Section 119 requires MnDOT to issue certain any necessary permits to the City of Rochester to construct a Trunk Highway 52 interchange. Section 120 has actually been enacted separately. The governor just signed that.
What page was on? Yeah. 117 and 119.
77. You mean in the R, in the revisor deck?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
R90 and R91.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, these last ones are out of order because they match up with the House. The revisor matched them up with the House, right? So Section 125 on R92 relates to the earlier provision that established the Pupil Transportation Safety Office, and this requires a report to the legislature by January 15 of 2009. Then on R92, Section 126 requires the Commissioner of Transportation, in conjunction with the Met Council and local governments, to study a complete streets policy that would be applicable to construction of streets and roads, and to report to the Legislative Transportation Committees by December 5, 2008. Section 128 on R93 is a $1 million Trunk Highway Fund appropriation to Department of Public Safety to implement and operate the Office of Pupil Transportation Safety. The last two provisions have to do with the article that clarifies provisions in the transportation funding law that was enacted earlier this year. Article 2, Section 7 on R103 clarifies the effective date for vehicle registration tax changes. And Article 2, Section 9 makes a small change by just deleting an unnecessary term that was probably carried over from previous versions and then never defined and never used. So that concludes the Senate-only provisions.
Thank you. Ms. Berezovsky, I think we should discuss, if people have any items of discussion they wanted to discuss on, after going through the side-by-side.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Madam Chairman, I actually have a couple here. Senator Jungbauer and Senator Dibble have been working on, they're kind of separate issues. One, you know, it's a complete streets issue with Senator Jungbauer, and I think that Senator Dibble has worked with maybe Representative Hausman on some bike lane issues, and just want to throw a plug in there. They've worked pretty hard on this stuff, and I think it's good. We need to have these discussions about, you know, complete streets and alternative forms of transportation, and I'd hope that, you know, we could keep these in our final report.
Let me just ask Senator Murphy and members if there isn't a lot of discussion as to what we just heard, if we wanted to have MnDOT maybe run through their list of concerns with the bill. Representative Hausman.
I just want to make some observation relative to on the summary sheets, page 5, R67, the annual transit report, and then on page 11, the Transit Service Needs Implementation Plan, and just put it in the context of some language that was in the bonding bill that was vetoed, and there was funding in the bonding bill for lines to Duluth and Rochester and Chicago, and accompanying that, it was suggested to us by the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative that we put some language in there. One of them was to direct MnDOT to work with the Wisconsin DOT to work on intercity rail. And then before we can seek federal funding, there needs to be a state plan for intercity rail. And so that language was in there, the direction to MnDOT to develop a statewide plan. The money was vetoed because he said we don't have a statewide plan. But then he also vetoed the line that said they should do a statewide plan. So when I see this language, it occurs to me, I mean, we're asking for reports and implementation plans, and whether we assume that will get to the language that were we to begin to have conversation with other states, would this implementation plan meet the requirements to seek federal funding? My understanding is before you can seek federal funding for that intercity rail, you've got to have the statewide plan for intercity rail. So,
Representative Hausman, my understanding of the joint rules of the House and Senate are that any language that's passed either the floor of either body is eligible for consideration in a conference committee. And so if there's some language from the vetoed bonding bill that fits with some of the provisions that are in this bill, we can look at adopting language like that by amendment. It's my understanding. So maybe we should take a look at that.
And Madam Chairman and Representative Hausman, it's funny that you mentioned that because, we don't have a statewide rail plan in regard to either moving goods or moving people. And we've been working with some representatives from the railroad on a statewide rail plan. And if there's something in here that we can do to kind of massage the language, I think that we need to move forward so that we aren't excluding ourselves from the opportunity of building high-speed rail or whatever it might be.
Other discussion?
And then the other one that's actually throughout here in a variety of ways is this issue of the transit taxing district. And House and Senate have different approaches, and, I mean, in some ways I thought almost some competing language. And what's clear as we look at a system is everywhere those lines are going to go outside the seven-county metro area. And that issue of the transit taxing district has, I mean, it just grows more complex and has, and maybe even sets up barriers to good decision-making. So as we look at this language, I think there's always the question of how the transit taxing district fits, period, at a time when we know that the system we build is inevitably going to break through the boundaries of that mm-hmm. district everywhere. And then how do you equitably mm-hmm. deal with that?
Senator Murphy.
And Madam Chairman, and maybe Senator Dibble can speak to this better than I can, but that there was a reason why that we put some language, that we were carrying language earlier to talk about maybe capturing the value of any increase in value in those transit corridors. And I know what you're talking about. If they ever run the Red Rock to Red Wing or Winona, you know, our counties of Goodhue and Wabasha and Winona counties should be on the hook for some of this money. And this was a proposal that I believe might be the Speaker's proposal. It might be in this bill. I forget where. It's someplace out here. Trust me on that one. You know, we need to look at that. And I think she worked on that in conjunction with the Chamber of Commerce. I think it's an idea that makes sense. Anyway, that but the taxing district per se, as it is in the Senate bill, is actually a pretty good idea.
Senator Dibble?
I just wanted to say that we're not just talking about the future. We're talking about the present. Today, folks who are outside of the transit taxing district are benefiting from the tax effort that those inside the transit taxing district expend. Folks are driving in to the boundary, hopping on, you know, using the capital facilities, the park and rides, hopping on the buses that are paid for with transit taxing district taxes. Additionally, the buses that are used by some paratransit contract providers go out of the transit taxing district, go pick up folks and give them transit service. So there's a lot of effort going on inside this subset of the metro area that benefits folks out to the edges of the metro and, frankly, beyond. Can't do much about that right now. So we're not just talking about planning for the future. We're talking about who pays and who benefits today.
I think what might make sense from a time management perspective is to go through MnDOT's list of concerns about items in the bill, and then when they're through, I'm assuming that'll take about 20 minutes. Then if we could break, and Senator Murphy, till 1 o'clock or 1:30.
Well, you have the gavel, but 1:30 sounds even better.
Okay. So we'll listen to what MnDOT has to say, their concerns about the bill. We'll break at about noon. We'll reconvene at 1:30. It's my hope that Senator Murphy and I might have a chance to speak with the commissioner before we reconvene at 1:30 if he's around and available. But Betsy Parker, if, I don't know if you or Eric want to speak to MnDOT's concerns.
And Madam Chair. And
Senator Murphy.
And Madam Chair, I think we need to let the Met Council have an opportunity to come up here after you, Ms. Parker, and discuss why they really like the transit taxing district expansion. They don't like it.
Senator Murphy, as long as that's a comment and not the beginning of a conversation, I think we can do that before lunch. Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I gave Senator Murphy yesterday a summary of our concerns about the bill, and I brought some copies with me. I don't know if you have a copy or not.
Either or, it doesn't matter.
The department had, I'll just run through our list here. I think, as you know, in the House version for the UPA, there was language added that would require that would require the department to do a study of the feasibility of implementing a UPA kind of project on three other corridors, Rush Line, Red Rock, and I-94. And we thought that sometime in the future that would probably be an appropriate thing to do, but that it's premature to start it before we even finish determining whether it works on 35W and before there's any money available for it. It just seemed like it should wait a few years and let us report back to the legislature and see how it works on 35W. So we would like to have that language removed from the bill. In the second thing is the road de-icing study in the House version of the bill. The department is very supportive of efforts to make the most appropriate use of chemicals to address snow and ice on the roads, and in fact we do look at this very carefully, and we also do work with the PCA on impacts on state waters. However, I have a list with me, which I could pass out if you wanted to see it, of all of the studies that MnDOT has agreed to in the 2007 and 2008 policy bills, and they number 17, and 10 of them are due in January or February of 2009. And as you know, we have quite a bit of work to do in MnDOT these days, and we're content to do all of the studies, those 17 already on our list, but we were really hoping desperately that we would not be asked to do any more studies. We simply don't have the people or the budget for it. This would have to be outsourced at a cost of about $50,000. There's no way we could comply with the requirement in the law that it be concluded by January of 2009. And so we were hoping that you would remove the road de-icing study. The third thing is the railroad walkway safety language. Yesterday when I talked to Senator Murphy about that, he gave me new language to replace that language that is in the House bill. And the department is comfortable with the language that Senator Murphy gave me. I have not, we just looked at it yesterday. I think that I probably need to confirm with the governor's office that there's no discomfort about the budget implications of that. And it does allow us to set fees for dealing with some of those disputes. And I had talked to Senator Murphy about the possibility of exempting MnDOT from rulemaking. And there's also a Department of Finance statute that governs setting fees. That would, the rulemaking would be a very long, complicated process and would let us get underway with that, assuming that it's there are no other objections to it. In the Senate, I believe, as you know, the department has been testifying against the design-build language, and I suppose this would be an appropriate time to take the opportunity to tell you that I met with Commissioner Sorrell this morning, and I asked him what he wanted to do about the design-build language that is being proposed in both bodies. And he told me that he only started at MnDOT this week, and he told me that he would like to take the opportunity over the summer to meet with members of the construction industry and to talk to MnDOT people about the design-build process, that he feels that there needs to be discussion about possible changes to it, and that he wants an opportunity to consider all of those things, and that he doesn't feel that he can adequately consider it in the next week or two, and that he has also told the governor's office that he is committed to meeting with anyone from the construction contract industry, the AGC, the consulting engineers, and he would like to see what sort of resolution of those issues can be worked out. And so for that reason, he would ask that the legislature not enact any changes to the design-build law now. UPA noise walls, that's addressed. The Highway 52 interchange in Rochester, the department has begun a process to work with Rochester and to split the cost of the environmental studies that are needed for the interchange at 65th Street. We would like to request that you remove that language from the bill. It also has fiscal implications in the future for MnDOT with respect to the language that requires us to make improvements at 55th Street Those would simply come in their own time. And with respect to the transit implementation language, the department readily agreed that it needs to do more work on transit planning outstate and is happy to enlarge the transit plan that it prepares every year or the transit report. Our only concern about that is the requirement, I believe it's in the House bill, that says that we must implement that plan simply because in our revenue forecast there is not money predicted to be available to allow us to meet that 80%. So if you could for now take out the "and implement" language, we can report back to you on a planning process about what it's going to take and how the anticipated resources and needs stack up so that future work can be done on that. In both bills, there is language requiring the department to award bids to a contractor that was a low bidder on a project on which the department rejected all bids in January. The department had advertised for bids for a project on Trunk Highway 53. It's called the Miller Mall Project. It goes right through the heart of Duluth. Mm-hmm. And it is a joint federal, state, city, county project. It has 80% federal funding in it. We will be signing cooperative agreements with the city and the county to share the cost of that because it affects both state and local roads. After the bids were opened, we discovered that Duluth intended to enforce an ordinance requiring significant setbacks that would have required the acquisition of large parts of parking lots belonging to tenants in the Miller Mall, Kohl's and Target, which would have cost probably several million dollars and delayed the start of the project. Apparently, Duluth had not said anything about that ordinance before the bids were opened. And so rather than delay the project for some months, we rejected all bids. Senator Bach and Representative Rukavina have developed language that would require us to award the project anyway. And we did work with Senator Bach to develop language that would say that we would award the project if the city and the county signed the cooperative agreements, which we have been told they may not do, and if the Federal Highway Administration approved it for federal funding, which we have been told they probably will not do, because they require all projects, once bids are rejected, to be rebid. And also the project description has now been changed. So that presents legal problems for us. We did work with Senator Bach on the language. We would prefer not to have the language. If the legislature is determined that it should be in the bill, we would vastly prefer the Senate language because it does address concerns of all four levels of government. With respect to the Lafayette Bridge, this largely concerns the fact that no transit alternative has yet been selected for that corridor. The bridge, which is planned to be under construction in 2011, will be built with 12-foot shoulders both inside and outside of the driving lanes to accommodate BRT. That will be part of the highway cost of the bridge. It will be necessary because no route has been chosen for LRT, and the city of St. Paul doesn't have agreement with anybody about where the termini of the LRT line should be to build a separate bridge, which requires separate footings, which would not be a trunk highway cost and would cost $7 million just for the footings and over $120 million for the bridge at a later time, all non-highway costs. So that poses a problem for us. Largely, it's an issue of timing and no determination about location and things yet to be resolved with the city of St. Paul and Dakota County, I believe. And then, as you know, the administration objects to the changes to the Chapter 152 language that is in the bill as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Murphy.
Madam Chair, Ms. Parker, just a couple of questions here. And first, in regards to Lafayette Street Bridge, we heard a lot of the same opposition from MnDOT when we were asking that the I-35W bridge be transit ready for light rail. And, you know, so that's kind of the song and dance that we've heard before, and we need to come to a resolve. We need the department to help us find a way to yes instead of no on that issue. The other two issues that I just want to bring up, Ms. Parker, is one, you didn't say anything about the Department of Public Safety's opposition to the deletion of a certain date that they had asked to be put in our funding bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, I believe it is best for the Department of Public Safety to speak for itself.
Is there somebody here from the Department of Public Safety that's prepared to talk on this? Mr. Olala.
Go for it. Senator Murphy, it's okay. I have trouble with his last name, so it's better if you say it.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Larry Olala. I'm the Vehicle Services Program Director with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services Division.
Pull the mic closer.
The provision in the bill under Chapter 152, is that what you're referring to?
Yes, sir.
That was a portion that we hope is very clear. It deals with the new registration tax, and the way that the language was currently written, or what was written, was a period starting September 1st, 2008 to August 31st, 2009. It did not mean that was going to end on August 31st, 2009. It meant that period was beginning during that time. The language was specifically written that way to avoid any conflict. We had an issue a number of years ago with definition of when a registration period was supposed to start. It's confusing because really the first people that are affected have an August 2009 expiration on their license plate, and yet it starts September 1st, 2008. So we wanted to avoid that. The department is neutral in this provision. We feel it has the same force and effect either way it's written. So,
okay. And Madam Chair, then Mr. Ola, I'll cut right to the chase. Now, the department intends to continue to collect this tax even after this date passes.
That's correct.
And under the new schedule?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, good. Thank you. Madam Chair?
Senator
and Ms. Parker, the very last item on your list, the changes to the flexible highway account, why is the department objecting to that reference?
Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, I believe the administration feels that that language has already been passed into law, and that it should not be changed again within 6 years, and also that if it changes the way the tax is distributed, it may amount to a tax increase.
Madam Chair, Ms. Parker, can you say that again, please? You caught me off guard. Oh, Madam Chair,
Senator Murphy.
Ms. Parker, is there somebody from the governor's office that can answer this? This isn't Ms. Parker's fight. Is there somebody from the governor's office? Is there somebody from the governor's office?
Maybe at 1:30 there will be.
Okay.
Senator Murphy, are you done? I have two more people on the list, or did you have another
follow-up? Oh, no, that's fine.
Okay. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess my question or comment was going to what Senator Murphy asked about Lafayette Bridge, is that my understanding in the past, in the Bloomington Ferry Bridge is one that comes to mind. Again, this is the discussion we had last fall after the bridge collapse, but that we have done this in the past where we put in footings for future light rail and when there isn't a route already planned there. So I don't understand why we're rehashing this again, because we've done this in the past. It's my understanding.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I have been told that it was done with federal demonstration funds, not with trunk highway funds.
Ms. Parker, I just have a quick question about the 35W bridge. The money that we got from the federal government to replace that bridge, that's an earmark, isn't it, that we got?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're kind of focused on these last things. I have something up the list as well, but I just want to say on the Lafayette Bridge, Ms. Parker articulated that transit mode had not yet been selected for that bridge, which I'm glad she said that, because that really points to how we kind of balkanize our transportation decision-making in the metropolitan area and all over the state. Why are we building a huge, expensive bridge, and we're not thinking about the transportation needs, all of the transportation needs into the future? We're making a huge investment. So why isn't that factored into the planning? I mean, and I go back to what I've said previously. How much did we add to the expense of Hiawatha when we had to build another bridge for the flyover, Lake Street? Why is it cost prohibitive to send LRT down into the southern suburbs across the Cedar Avenue Bridge, which, by the way, I now understand, now that I've been educated a little bit, there was actually rider policy language that said that Cedar Avenue should have been built sufficient to support a train, and there was some strange interpretation on some narrow way that you could read that sentence, that rider language, if you turned your head sideways, that allowed MnDOT to get out of building that bridge sufficient to hold a train. So now we have this barrier at the river, at Cedar Avenue, creating this kind of the fiscal pain, so we can't complete or draw the southern suburbs into that transit service very easily. So why would we go headlong into making a foolish decision like that, not considering all the options available to us? It's a huge flaw we have in how we think about transportation, how we pay for it, how we plan for it. I look forward to hearing from the governor's office about item number 6. Page 2, I just want to go back to the school bus safety stuff. I think I'm happy the Department of Education says they're working on something. This has to do with making sure that when school districts are contracting for private bus service for student transportation, that there be a little bit of sunlight and disclosure. I think it's the duty and role of the legislature to articulate exactly what they want to see. So that's the goal to be responsive to, and I would, if anyone hasn't read the legislative auditor's report, please do. It's very thorough, very specific, and there's some very interesting and unpleasant information about how well we're managing private student and student transportation in general all across the state. It's very, very expensive. It needs to be managed to the best extent we possibly can. And even though the private contract arrangements are supposed to save money, that's the premise, school districts that are using private contractors are paying more money than those who are providing the service in-house.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go back to your very first point, the UPA report. I'm a little confused. You say the language is premature about additional East Metro corridors and introduces significant complexity. As I look at it, you say the portions of the project will be open by 2009. The crosstown portion will be open by 2010. As I read the language, no work on any reporting has to start until 2011. It says starting with January 2011, after portions are open, then let's look at evaluating the strategies and develop recommendations. I think the reason those three are mentioned, there is growing alarm in the East Metro, and that includes in our business community, that at this point there is not one single corridor assured. Of course, that includes Central Corridor. Not one single corridor assured in the East Metro. And I think that language, it didn't come from me. I think it came from Jeremy Kalin, but that alarm is felt every year with greater urgency. And so I don't see the premature or complex problems that you're citing, because we were way out to 2011.
Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, in order to report in 2011, we would need to start studying it in advance and look at the traffic that is there now and try to project for the future, and then try to determine, I think, how it relates to whatever we're learning from the UPA project, which won't be fully implemented until 2010.
Ms. Parker, here's how I read that. Starting with January 15, 2011, evaluate strategies and develop recommendations for. As I read that language, it says you begin in 2011 to evaluate and develop recommendations.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, I'm sorry, but I can't find the language in the side-by-side.
It's on R85, and it's lines 4911, 4912. I don't quite have the side-by-side figured out either yet.
Okay,
but
thank you.
Starting with January 2011, evaluate strategies and develop recommendations. As I read that language, you don't have to do anything until 2011.
It's at 98.
Representative Hausman and Ms. Parker, it appears there might be an extraneous word, the, that creates some confusion in line 49.11, where it says starting with, and then it has a the, January 15th, 2011. It almost sounds like it's referring to a report dated January 15th, 2011. But if you delete what I think is an extraneous the right before the word January, then Representative Hausman's interpretation seems to be what the statute would be saying.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, I don't think the word the is extraneous. If you look at line 48.28 on page R85, it says, by January 15, 2009, and on January 15, each year through 2014, the commissioner shall report. And I think it was intended to read, starting with the January 15, 2011 report, because he wanted to pick a starting year.
Continue reading.
And in each report thereafter, evaluate strategies.
I don't see evaluate strategies and develop recommendations until 2011.
I think that maybe the comma is extraneous. But what we could maybe look at is changing the language in 48.28. So that the looking at how effective this strategy is in that corridor starts after we have a chance to figure out whether it's an effective strategy in that corridor. So maybe when we look at moving this language, we'll want to make some minor changes to it so it's more clear. I have Senator Olsen, but I would like to also hear from Met Council briefly before we go to lunch. So, Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Parker, I have a question on page 2. In both versions, item number 3, the transit implementation, we presented that bill in the Senate side, and afterwards the MnDOT folks came to me and were concerned about, you know, having the revenue and stuff for that. But my concern is that, you know, we've got an unmet need. And
Senator Olsen, I'm sorry, what are you talking about, which part?
On her
page 2.
Yeah, on her page 2.
Her page 2 and which item?
Item number 3.
Thank you.
The transit implementation.
Thank you.
So after it was presented in the Senate, some of the MnDOT transit folks came to me and said they were concerned about just what's laid out here, that they couldn't meet that. But I guess my point is that we should be more worried that we have people that primarily depend on these transit systems because of maybe physical handicaps or something like that. And so I'm disappointed that MnDOT's maybe not willing to kind of step up to the plate more and address an unmet need. I mean, it seems like a pretty low bar to me that, you know, 80% of the unmet need by 2015, that's a concern. I would rather see an approach where they would say, you know, if we can't have the funds, these are the kinds of funds we need to meet this need. I don't like the comment that, you know, we can't do this. I would rather see you guys come back and say, you know, this is what it would take and let us figure out how to get those resources. So I have a concern with kind of the attitude expressed here, that because I think this is very important. We have a population in this state that obviously has unmet transportation needs, and we need to address that.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, the department agrees with you entirely that there are unmet needs, especially for people with special needs related to transportation. And we do everything in our power and within our budget to meet those needs to the best of our ability. And we, our transit people, will be very happy to do any report desired to show what the needs are. We are, as you know, we have a budget cycle that we go through, and we only request money in accordance with that budget cycle. And we will be doing that again. We will be this summer beginning to prepare the budget for the next biennium. Our only concern was that given the resources we have now, no matter how hard we studied it, we probably couldn't meet those because of the needs that exist. There's no attempt on the part of MnDOT to deny that there are many unmet needs and that we wish we could meet them all, but it isn't feasible given the resources that are available today.
Ms. Parker, Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Parker, wouldn't it be appropriate then for you to say this is what it would take and then let us figure out if we can address the financial part of it?
Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, yes, I believe it would be, and I think that that is what we will do in the transit plan, just as we do with our highway plans when we identify projects that have been identified as needed and what the cost is. We will be identifying what it would cost to, you know, the plan will show what the needs are, and I believe the plan will also show what it would take to meet those needs.
Ms. Parker, if I can just comment on the House side of this. When we had this discussion in the Transportation Policy Committee, it was our concern that we weren't getting information from MnDOT about how much money was required to get to the point where we were serving these needs. And in order for us to decide whether to raise revenue to meet the needs, we needed to know what kind of a plan there could be to meet the needs and how much it would cost to get there. Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm following up on both your comments. Ms. Parker, in the past, did MnDOT provide an explanation of unmet transit needs in greater Minnesota and the revenue needed to address those needs?
Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair and Representative Morrow, MnDOT has done transit plans. I'm not sure what the duration of those plans was. In other words, I'm not sure how far out they looked. Last year, there was legislation introduced that proposed standards in order standards that MnDOT and Met Council should meet about providing transit service. For example, provide transit service across county lines, or provide service so many hours a day or so many days a week. And I might be mistaken about this, but I don't think we had ever done any transit planning in the context of those kinds of service descriptors. And at last year, when we had those bills before us, I believe we came up with an estimate, and I can't remember the time frame for this exactly, or maybe it was about $200 million a year, I think. Judd is nodding that that's correct, to meet those needs. And so we did, during the session, do a rough estimate of what we thought it would take to get there. And I believe that MnDOT's transit budget is in the neighborhood of $25 million a year. And so that led to a discussion about, well, taking those specific descriptors of service out and then doing a transit planning process that would go out some years and identify what different levels of service would require. And I believe that our transit office is eager to do that kind of plan and provide you with the information.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm trying to just understand, and I appreciate what the department's going to do from this point forward in terms of, try to put it in simple terms, no, you don't have the transit you need in greater Minnesota, and this is what it's going to cost to get it. But before 2007, did MnDOT do that, say you don't have this transit in greater Minnesota, and this is what it's going to cost to get it, and tell the legislature that number?
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, I believe that we did. Okay. I don't think it was quite the kind of transit plan that has been contemplated since the discussion began last year, but I am certain that our Office of Transit has done transit planning. because all of the decisions about where and how to begin new service are made based on a plan that ranks, attempts to rank needs and requests for service. So we have done transit planning, but I don't think it was to the extent that is now envisioned. And the department is happy to do the transit planning on a more expansive basis.
I think it's fair to say that the legislature and the governor probably have had different visions with regard to transit, and the legislature and MnDOT have had different visions with regard to transit in terms of setting goals and meeting goals and making progress along the lines to get to those goals. And, you know, since this commissioner has only been on board for a week, I think we should kind of the jury should be out for a while about where we go from here, and we should maybe visit with him about this topic before we make decisions on that. Representative Hausman has a question, and my hope is that it's short and that we can hear from Judge Shetnan briefly after that, and then we'll take our lunch break.
And mine is just to the conferees what I'll bring this afternoon. Because I'm working on some transit governance issues, not only metro but statewide, I have some information. And one thing that's been prepared by Aaron Isaacs is about a three-page specifically on intercity transit in greater Minnesota. And he points out that there is a huge amount happening. And I was shocked to discover the number of companies that have already set up from the airport connections. And he makes a series of recommendations about how we could build on what's already there. And given the fact that in several places here we're looking at Greater Minnesota Transit, I might bring that this afternoon and to take a look at the recommendations that he makes.
Sounds good. I'm a fan of Aaron Isaacs. I have Representative Earhart and Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, when we're talking about transit and disabled, I think we should step up the thoughts about the grain of America here, which is upon us. First two waves of the baby boomers are retiring, and just a few more years they won't be able to drive, and we need to provide transit for them. And that's a huge thing compared to what the disabled problem is. So let's not forget them when we're doing our planning.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Parker, I think I understood your comments regarding the design build provisions, but on the handout it says that a list of provisions that MnDOT can agree to is attached, and there's no attachment. So is there still a list that the department is willing to agree to, or I thought you were pretty clear that the commissioner stated now that he would like no changes until...
Senator Sieben, I think Senator Murphy might have that list somewhere.
We definitely have that list, Senator Sieben, and we'll provide it to you. I did have a discussion, Representative Leader and myself, with a new commissioner this morning, and we talked about the design build, and he sees some value in some of the things that we have here, but he, once again, I'll reiterate what Ms. Parker said, that he'd like to have some time to kind of digest a couple of the large issues that hang up our bill here, and that's the cap, you know, making sure that we're not spending more than 120% of the low bid, and then also some of the provisions on how things are counted. So I think that hopefully before... maybe before Wednesday or so of next week, we'll have something put together that will give everybody a little bit of comfort.
Thank you. Okay, if we could have Judge Shetnan from the Met Council go through. Thank you, Ms. Parker, for sharing those concerns. And we'll try to briefly hit on Met Council's concerns and then break for lunch. Mr. Shetnan.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here before you, and I in the note I sent to both Senator Murphy and to you, Madam Chair, that the council is very pleased that there are a number of provisions in this bill that the council is in full agreement with the House and Senate. There are two sections and a repealer section that the council does have a few issues with, and I would like to address them. They're considering the transit taxing district, and I would like to respond to Senator Dibble's comments earlier. He's exactly right. I mean, we have had long-standing issues with the transit taxing district. There are studies that we've done, license plate studies. We can show where people are coming from to use these park and rides. They also ride our buses. There are a number of issues with the taxing district. We feel that if the legislature were to ask the council to impose this tax, that it would be a new tax, and that gives the administration some concern, and it is concern of the council's. We are working.
Senator Murphy, I'm sorry, Mr. Shenton. Senator Murphy, you had a comment along those lines.
No, Madam Chairman, just a question for the Met Council, and maybe you can get a reply later in the day, but all those provisions that you like in the bill, how much do you like them?
Senator Murphy and Madam Chair, we do like them a lot, and you know, I think
we do too.
I know. I think that it shouldn't come as a big surprise. I don't think to the conference committee. I mean, this has been an issue going back to 2003, and we have stated our concerns with this. I will let you know that the council and the governor has suggested that we voluntarily work with communities to have them come in. And the UPA agreement has given us that opportunity to work with the city of Lakeville. I think we're very, very close to having a city come in voluntarily. That will be the first time a city has ever volunteered to come in. So we are making some progress that way. But I will be honest that the UPA has made that much, much easier to happen.
Senator Murphy.
And Mr. Shetland, you like the UPA agreement too, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, I do, and I think that the administration does. I also believe that the House and Senate are very supportive of the UPA. It's traveling
as well
by
as the House and Senate are very supportive of increasing the size of the taxing district.
Mr. Shetland.
Madam Chair, I understand Senator Murphy's point.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Shetland, you were going to speak to two provisions, and I'm sorry, I didn't know if you got to the second.
Madam Chair, those two provisions were in the Senate file. It's sections 112 and 113, and the side-by-side, they are on page... Page 25, sections 82 and 83, and then as Ms. Berezovsky mentioned earlier, that there are some repealers that would accompany this that were on a different page. Maybe Ms. Berezovsky can point that out, but it's just the only provisions are those dealing with the taxing district.
Pages 82.
Representative Hausman. Representative Hausman, did you have a question for Mr. Shetland?
Well, I was going to give Mr. Shetland a choice because it seems to me we either have to expand the taxing district or repeal the taxing district, one or the other, for equity and to make any of this work. We either have to expand it or repeal it.
Mr. Shetland.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, those are it's a good question. I don't have the answer for you right now. I don't think that we can repeal it because we have 30 years of outstanding bonds that need to be paid through that transit levy. The expansion, it is an interesting idea. I have sat here and I've said many times that there are longstanding issues with this. The problem is that those folks who are not within the taxing district right now, if this were levied, it would be a new tax. And the administration and the council have not supported that.
Apparently, more people than I had eggs for breakfast, and they're not in Big Brush for lunch. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think some communities have thought of perhaps figuring out when people come into their community from outside their community to take advantage of facilities and services that the host community has paid for, gone to great effort, great expenditure, tax dollars. They thought, well, maybe we'll figure out who those folks are and charge them a little permit fee or, charge them like a per person, if they're going to come and enjoy this on a regular basis and not pay for it. Maybe they should pay for it. Has the Met Council contemplated some sort of policy or mechanism to do something like that? I think in Apple Valley, they're trying to identify the Lakeville people who are coming in. Now, it sounds like there might be peace in the valley down in the South Metro, but this is
close.
This is going on all over the metropolitan area.
I don't think
area.
There's peace yet.
So. Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I know that Representative Madore and I may differ on this, but I think that we are close to getting somewhere close to peace in the valley in the Apple Valley, Lakeville area. We will find out Monday night. The Lakeville City Council will be taking up a resolution voluntarily coming into the taxi district. As far as the permitting, we had this discussion, it must have been 2 years ago. The tax committee was considering whether or not you could pass these permits. The issue that was created with permitting is other than just the transit bonds, the capital that is raised through those taxes that are levied within the taxing district, there are other monies that go into that, and the federal money that goes into it, the regional money, which is levied through the taxing district, and the state money would not allow for any type of restriction of use to those who are just within the taxing district, because there are a number of monies that go into that. And in particular for the Apple Valley Park and Ride Station that will be at the Watson's lot, we're very excited that we're going to have a great structure there. And that money is being funded with dollars from state general obligation bonding dollars, and everybody in the state pays for that facility. So anybody from Warroad to Worthington has every right to use that facility.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Thanks, and I think that makes the point very beautifully. The only fair way to do this is by expanding the transit taxing district. Mm-hmm. Not only is the alternative not legal, it's probably not, it's not proper, and it's not fair.
I would note for the tape and for people who are listening but not watching, we just did have passed out a handout on the license plate study, which shows where people are coming from that are using facilities in the transit taxing district. I refer to this as the freeloader chart because it shows all the red dots outside of the transit taxing district to me show where the freeloaders live. And I understand the administration's position that if we were to expand the transit taxing district, that would be a tax increase. But another way to look at it is it would be a tax decrease for those of us who already live in the transit taxing district, and perhaps by distributing the tax more fairly across all users of the system, the corresponding decrease in our taxation would be offset by the increase for some other. So it might not be a increase, but rather a redistribution of the tax burden to a more fair system. I had Senator Youngbauer and then Senator Murphy.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think but Mr. Shetland made a pretty good case. I think we are on the verge of many communities being ready to opt in, and I think you risk that by just putting a new boundary out. In the one of the greatest examples is my community of East Bethel that's been trying to get a bus for many years. And so if you all automatically bring them in now, they are working with Met Council on some other things. They see a great benefit there. If all of a sudden you put the taxing district out there with no service of bus line or something else without having a corresponding plan that way, I do think you get a great deal of pushback. I think we're so close to making this work that I think right now just expanding it without some corresponding benefits to these outer lying communities you're going to get a lot of pushback. We're going to have some problems and and risk the bill. So I think we're close. I think, and Mr. Shetland and I have had this discussion. We're hoping to work towards being able to, you know, get some type of a service out there simultaneously with getting the communities. And we've had that discussion in my district. I've had people talk about that at every town hall meeting we've had about getting ready to be included in that taxing district. So we're close, but I don't want to jeopardize it with, you know, all of a sudden putting out there, great, it lessens the burden inside there where there are the services. I got a big problem with putting it into effect without putting some corresponding service out there. And like I say, Met Council is working with us on some other wastewater treatment plant out there, which would increase density, which is a good way to get some new riders out there and a good way for the community to say, we want to opt in. The time is right. We've got the people, the riders. It's a benefit for everybody, and we're so close to that. I just see this as jeopardizing that by forcing something that is so close to being ready.
Well, Madam.
Senator Murphy.
Well, Madam Chair, since you can't hear the discussion going on at the other end of the table over the growling of my stomach, I think that maybe we should just retire until about 2:15 and come back and pick this up.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I can't quite make out the blue button on Mr. Shetland's towel. Can he read that to me?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I'll be happy to. It is a button that reads, many voices, one message, build the Central Corridor. And
expand the taxing.
Yeah, thanks, Senator Murphy.
I had on my list before, but my hope is maybe we'll be okay to talk about after lunch, would be Representative Nelson, Senator Murphy, and Representative Hausman. You want to wait until after lunch, or
well, if it's on this subject, is it possible just to? I mean, if we're very brief, mine is very brief.
I don't think he'll faint. Okay. So go ahead, Representative Hausman.
I was on this subject also.
Is he first?
Oh, actually, he was first, Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, and members here, I think this is just the first of many discussions about expanding taxing or expanding funding for rails as we look at the vision that's out there of rail and transit across the state in the 2020 plan. I'm old enough to remember when they expanded the bus lines into Brooklyn Center out from the border of Minneapolis. And before that, my parents would have to take us down to 49th and Osseo Road to catch a bus. And when they expanded it out so we could walk to the bus, I remember that. I was old enough to remember that. So, I mean, this is just the beginning of, I think, a discussion of how we're going to fund transit and transit across multiple corridors as we move forward, because I think most of us here have the vision of expanding rail service throughout our state. And so, but this is just the first of many of these, I think, that we're going to run into.
Representative Hausman.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to make the point that the more I hear this discussion, I think repeal is the only fair thing, because I would just tell the story of Rosemont that's been in the taxing district for 30 years and I believe has not a parking lot. And Lakeville, on the other hand, that is actively involved in negotiating their entire package and will have millions of dollars of capital improvement. And the dilemma of those who have been in there for a very long time and then others who are, we're apparently trying to lure in by letting them negotiate their own package, that unfairness and resentment will grow by where we are. So I do believe, earlier I talked about the choice, expand or repeal, and I do believe that repeal is ultimately a direction we're going to have to go. And then we won't have to raise taxes.
On that note, we will be in recess until 2 o'clock.